Thanks for tuning in. I'm Rebecca Kent. Our guest today is very much an industry leader of the present day. And if you're interested in emulating the success of one of property's most respected people, then definitely keep listening. In his spare time, our special guest sings.
You're not going to ask me to sing now, are you?
No, because I think that's the worst thing to ask a singer.
Good.
I don't imagine you would sing for us, would you?
No. Ask me, see what happens. No, I wouldn't.
He goes fishing too. Like, serious fishing.
Well, yeah, I did catch a big fish in Scotland, it's true. But annoyingly, didn't have my camera with me, so there are people who question the authenticity of that. But I did have an amazing experience in 2016, yeah.
Well, I was going to say this because you obviously didn't tell the newspapers. Being a good journalist, I did try and verify this, and I had a bit of a Google and couldn't find anything.
Okay. I'm named in something called Trout and Salmon in the November edition. It talks about me and my 36.5-pound fish.
But through the week, our interviewee has even bigger fish to fry.
We're a top three organisation by assets under management in the UK.
Now, whatever you do, if you find yourself having a conversation with this man, just don't use the word institutional.
I take that as a mild insult to the extent that institutional conveys boring and conventional. So I one of the things I try and do is shake off that particular label, and I think, you know, we're trying to be creative.
Right, so banning the word institutional.
Well, you know, it has connotations. It has, I think, some slightly negative connotations.
We're really glad to welcome Bill Hughes, Head of Real Assets at Legal & General Investment Management. Over the next 40 minutes or so, we chat about a whole host of topics relating to careers in property, as well as the trends and the behaviours that are changing the face of the industry. Importantly, though, Bill casts his thoughts on young people and how they can meaningfully contribute to the real estate industry. I hope you enjoy the chat as much as I did. Welcome to the latest instalment of EG's Tomorrow's Leaders podcast. So in the studio with me today is probably one of the most influential people in UK real estate. Is that fair to say?
Well, that's very kind of you, Rebecca. I do what I can to be influential. You know, we've got a big business, and I think we're in the spotlight to some extent. So yeah, that might be some truth in that.
Great. Okay. So you know, not only are you, I guess, in, you know, one of our most in demand head honchos in the industry, but you also happen to hold the record for catching the biggest salmon in Scotland. So the property industry's very own Rex Hunt. Or is that an antiquated reference?
I did catch a big fish in Scotland, it's true. But annoyingly, didn't have my camera with me, so there are people who question the authenticity of that. But I did have an amazing experience in 2016, yeah.
Well, I was going to say this because you obviously didn't tell the newspapers. Being a good journalist, I did try and verify this, and I had a bit of a Google and couldn't find anything.
Okay. I'm named in something called Trout and Salmon in the November edition. It talks about me and my 36.5-pound fish. So that it is there, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. And not that I was questioning you, by the way. And was this in the sea or in a river? Take us through this experience.
It was on a river, salmon fishing on the edge between England and Scotland. I was with my 20-year-old son, who's slumped on a bench carrying a bit of a hangover, and he was supposed to be fishing. Actually, I was fishing the rod because he was too tired and not feeling very well, and then he saw me catch this enormous fish, which really he should have caught, but there you go. That's unlucky, I said at the time.
Well done. It's a bit of a keen fisherman.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's the best way I find of relaxing, getting time away from the office and completely zoning out. For me, that's the best rest, the best relaxation I can get.
Excellent. And now I should introduce you formally. I'm speaking to Bill Hughes, who's Head of Real Assets at Legal & General Asset Management. Well, one of the largest institutional property investment managers in the UK. Is that correct? Biggest in Europe? Biggest in the UK?
We're a top three organisation by assets under management in the UK. and interesting you use the word institutional. I take that as a mild insult to the extent that institutional conveys boring and conventional. So I one of the things I try and do is shake off that particular label, and I think, you know, we're trying to be creative.
Right, so banning the word institutional.
Well, you know, it has connotations. It has, I think, some slightly negative connotations. I think we're here to be creative and to be better than average. And the size of what we do is not really the feature that is most interesting or important. It's actually what we do.
Oh, that's really interesting. Is there perhaps a rebrand on the way, a la Lansic?
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to do that, but... We want to use the scale we have for sure, but I think we have an obligation to think creatively and challenge ourselves in terms of what we can do with that size.
Okay, that's really positive. All right, good to know. Now, Bill, you're incredibly multi-talented. You also sing.
Okay.
You sing in a choir.
You're not going to ask me to sing now, are you?
No, because I think that's the worst thing to ask a singer.
Good.
I don't
good.
Imagine you would sing for us, would
I
you?
No. Ask me, see what happens. No, I wouldn't.
So, I mean, tell us about your singing.
I was tempted into choral singing about 10 years ago. My father had done it, and I went for an audition, and they said... come on in. And there's a scarcity of men that sing in choirs typically, so I think you can probably go along with limited talent and more often than not find yourself welcome. And
Don't sell yourself short, Bill.
Harmony in music is something that I do particularly like, and if you find a good choir with a good repertoire and a good choir master, it's amazing. I tend to do it on a Monday night. And you work up towards a performance, and then you perform somewhere. So it's different. It's a contrast with work.
Yeah.
It's a way of getting away from the detail of what's going on in your head, and you can completely relax and find it stimulating in other ways.
And you've sung in some great places too, haven't you?
Yeah, we've been around the world a little bit. In the UK, Royal Albert Hall, St Paul's, Vatican. There's a trip to Leipzig in a couple of months' time. I'm not able to go on. But, you know, choirs do get around the world some amazing, generally amazing religious places typically, but not all the music's religious. But, yeah, it's amazing. It's an inspiring thing to do with some very different people, actually. You know, it's a very mixed group of people that get into that sort of thing.
Yeah, how wonderful. And how do you describe your voice? What...
I'm a bass, and the first bass tends to be slightly higher and the second bass is lower, so I'm right between the two. They never know quite what to do with me. if you sing Rachmaninoff, which is particularly low, none of us can sing it, so I'm a first bass. Ordinarily I would be a second bass.
And have you ever done any business deals with people you've met through the choir?
No. I think it's one of those in the choir context, I don't think anyone ever really knows what anyone does. So it's not networking.
So a complete outlet.
Yeah, absolutely. Anonymity. It's great. It's wonderful.
Okay, so, and we're not done with facts about Bill Hughes yet.
Right.
You have been a human guinea pig at some point for Legal & General. I'm referencing your year's stay in rental accommodation in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate?
Well, we've been thinking for some time about setting up a line of business in the build-to-rent space, and conventional wisdom is that the people who own rental property don't manage it well, and I thought it would be a good idea to put myself into the rental market and become a renter for a year to see what it was like. And it was in Shoreditch in a nice property, so it wasn't actually much of an ordeal. My children thought me being in Shoreditch was at one level slightly weird because that's not how they're, you know, I haven't got a beard or a top knot or anything. But they
it's
came
never
up
too
and,
late, Bill.
True. They came and spent time with me. But the more important thing is the rental experience was truly dreadful. It couldn't have been worse.
What was so bad about it?
I'll give you an example. So I signed the lease and I arranged to arrive in a furnished flat on Sunday afternoon about 4 o'clock. So I arrived with a car full of my stuff, opened the door, and the apartment was completely empty. So I was expecting there to be a bed, for mm-hmm. example. I had bed linen, but I didn't have a bed with me. There was absolutely nothing. So whilst they'd sold it as fully furnished to me, there was nothing there. On a Sunday afternoon, getting hold of the agent was impossible. So, you know, that's the sort of start that characterised what went on thereafter. Very badly organised, unresponsive, tried to keep all of the rental deposit at the end of the lease, which is what they do. Wholly unedifying experience. But it did teach me that whilst the standards are poor, I was thinking all the time about how would you go about professionalising that? What are the sorts of things that, as a customer renting, you might like to have and you might like to experience? And so I think there's a great opportunity. I generally think there's a good opportunity to improve the standards in the industry. And that's one thing that we're now becoming part of.
How are you doing that?
Well, so we've opened our first rental property. We've brainstormed and spent time around the table thinking about what would a customer want in a range of ways. One of the things we've done is get our Generation Y people on the grounds that might be a material part of the renting populace to talk about what matters to them. And for example, you know, not surprisingly, you come up with things like they want access to the internet, they want to be able to get an immediate response to a problem in the flat, they want to know how their energy costs and other associated utilities are being managed, and they want to see the data around that. There's an immediacy about what they want. They're not very patient individuals generally, and they care about the quality of the experience. So you know, we've tried to get our arms around that, but it's worth saying, it's definitely far from the truth that Gen Y are the only people who would choose to rent. There's lots of other elective renters, and so you know, we've sought to get feedback and input from other groups and other individuals. So yeah, I think we're making progress with that.
And do you think their needs are vastly different, you know, among age groups who would seek to live in rental property? Or is it broadly, do we all broadly sort of want the same thing?
Yeah, I think there's some things that everyone wants, which is value for money and a reliable experience and an owner of the real estate who's going to be fair and reasonable. That stuff, I think, goes for everybody. The access to technology and immediacy around that is something that the younger generation seem to prioritise more. But, you know, I'd be wary of clustering individuals and generalising too much about it. Actually, the experience we've got in our building in Salford that is now becoming occupied is that there's a wide mix of people across all dimensions. And in a sense, I think we're also learning that to generalise that everyone wants the same thing, or to generalise about the renter being the same sort of person, is probably somewhat misguided. And you've got to be versatile.
Hmm. Do you think this is something that young people in the industry can, or this sort of research, fact-finding, I suppose, can contribute to in a really meaningful way? Is this why it's important for the industry to be nurturing young talent? Because they can come in with these sort of experiences and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think, look, there's an inevitable feature that I'm trying to challenge a bit, which is senior people get to the top of businesses. They tend to be the people then who make the decisions. And of course, by then, they're somewhat out of touch with what the consumers, be it around retail or rental, actually really want to do. So I think it's a natural thing to try and gather in that the views of that group of people, because then you can definitely have a better chance of producing something that's more useful and more apposite. And you know, we aim to do that. I think a lot of businesses forget the fact that the people at the sharp end may well be in their 20s or early 30s. So yeah, we're doing what we can to get our arms around that and really make a difference. And, you know, for example, this month, I've got one of the Generation Y people coming along to every single executive director meeting. And the reason I'm doing that is so that he can contribute to what we're up to, what we're thinking about, and get a better sense of what the business is doing at a strategic and senior level. And he's got a different view of the world. It's very interesting, you know, because he's much younger. And that's overlooked by too many people, I think.
Mm. How did that lucky Gen Y person get selected to do this?
Because we went out and had a few drinks on a Thursday night, and he happened to be there, and I thought it was a good idea. And then the following Monday, he started coming to director meetings. So it's just an experiment. And I think experiments are worth doing, see what happens. The worst that can happen is it doesn't work, we won't do it anymore. But so far, I think it's been useful.
So presumably you're learning as much from him as he's learning from all of you.
Yeah, in the sense that he has got a different take on it. I'll give you an example. We were debating how we can get more out of the relationship we have with mainstream surveying firms. And because he's relatively junior in the industry, he sees things differently. And he, as an example, was offering the suggestion that we should formalise the connections at lots of different levels and all the way down to more junior individuals. Whereas up until that point, we'd thought it was important to connect at a senior level and then cascade it down in our own organisations. So it's looking at things from a different way around. And I think he's got a point.
There was a lesson right at the start of that. This whole idea began while you were having a beer outside of the workplace, which is a very nice segue into networking, yeah. I think. Is it something you enjoy doing?
Networking in the industry. Well, I think it's interesting. I think when you start out, networking is massively important, and you've got to be proactive and energetic about it and get around. Because that's how you get yourself known and that's how you get to meet people. And broadly speaking, I think real estate as an industry is pretty good at offering opportunities for that. I think as time goes by, you know, you probably ask yourself the question a bit more, what am I getting out of it? Where should I be? Not least because there are too many things to do and there's too little time. So I think I've become a bit more thoughtful and maybe selective about overt networking events. And it's often the case, isn't it? Sometimes the networking opportunities catch you by surprise and you weren't necessarily expecting to find opportunities. In MIPIM, now I spend, MIPIM in the south of France, I spend as much time as I can not being in meetings because I think actually there's a great opportunity that meeting people spontaneously is the thing that's, I think, the most useful and important part of it.
Mm. So what would be your advice to young people who are less comfortable or familiar or seasoned at networking? If they were in the same room as you, for example, what would you suggest they come up and say to you? What would really make them memorable to you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I tend to find myself most impressed by people who demonstrate some focus and a bit of knowledge. So if an individual's got a particular view about something useful and they're willing to talk about it, then I would find that specifically appealing. I'm not so interested in small talk in that context. I think it's about something useful, some germ of knowledge or topic or subject that someone's got a hold of and can say something useful about. There was a bit of networking happening at an event I was at yesterday, and the thing that I got into a discussion about, and I remember all the people from this conversation, so they've networked with me, and I've got their cards. We were talking about technology and real estate and the opportunities and the challenges around that. And there were a couple of people there who'd done some reading and done some thinking, and I found that stimulating because they got some views.
Mm. And so that would potentially, you'd be interested to hear what they have to say, presumably if they got in touch again or you're in contact again down the line.
Yeah, there were two or three people there who I probably will at some point in the next 6 weeks have another conversation with because they've got some interesting thoughts about something which I think is massively important for the industry.
Mm. Would you say you're quite generous with your, I guess, your knowledge and your advice with the young people in your firm, with the young people outside of the firm?
I try to be. I think if anyone's got a conversation going on with me, then the answer would be yes. I think the challenge for me is how much time there is. So if someone would say, can you spend 20 minutes over a cup of coffee, have a chat, I'd say yes, generally. But it would be 20 minutes and it wouldn't be an hour and it would be over coffee, it wouldn't be lunch, you know. So, trying to use the time, the scarce time resource, as sensibly as possible.
No time wasters, please.
I think that's probably right.
Tell us a little bit more about your job. What are the decisions you make on a day-to-day basis?
I think the first decision going through my mind most of the time is, where will I spend my time? Because at any point in time, I've got, you know, half a dozen or more things I could be doing. So that's the most important thing. It's about prioritisation. It's about, where does the business need me the most? Where can I delegate? Where can I delegate to people who can be trusted to do more? But, you know, if you were to look in my diary, it's full of almost a random array of things that seem unconnected, because we've got a portfolio of 24 billion assets in the UK with huge amounts of different issues around it. We've got a team of 150 people with a lot of management, ongoing management issues around that. We're looking to expand into the US, so we're spending some time contemplating that. Some of it's necessarily reactive, but of course, if I'm good at my job, then I make sure I've got time to be proactive and strategic and forward thinking. And you know, having the right balance there is always a challenge.
And how did you get to where you are now? Perhaps you could take us through your career path.
Yeah.
Would you describe it as conventional, or were there some sort of strange paths that, you know, do you go off at tangents at some point? Take us through it.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of both. I think there's some elements that are pretty much of a trodden path and other bits that perhaps aren't. It started, the simple way to describe it is at Edinburgh University. I did a degree in geography, which I call colouring in colloquially. So, you know, I enjoyed my time colouring in, but it was human geography. And the reality of it is that I did a degree for 4 years, which I loved. And that has transposed itself in large part into the job I do, because I, you know, human geography and how humans relate to the built environment is what I studied at university. So that's the fundamental bit. And it's not unusual for geographers to end up doing real estate related stuff.
No, presumably you're not colouring in now.
No, well, I've gone beyond that really. But,
and did you go into this degree kind of knowing what you wanted to do afterwards?
No idea at all. I think that perhaps the slightly less usual part of my career is that I went from research in a surveying firm through city exams and the analyst route, and then back into leadership. And I don't think that's necessarily such a trodden path. In a way, it would have been more normal for me to train as a surveyor, become a surveyor, you know, junior surveyor, fund manager, and then get to where I am. And I think I probably went through a more techy boffin route because I'm that way minded, I guess.
So, you know, what do you think were some of the traits and the behaviours, and what was the attitude that you possessed that, I guess, made you stand out as a potential leader?
First and foremost, I think endless curiosity. I can think of all the jobs that I've done, and I've always been characterised by a thirst for knowledge. I always want to know why, and then I want to know more. And so I think that if that is displayed in terms of enthusiasm, then I think that's pretty helpful, because then you can accumulate knowledge, you can actually become, in small areas, you can become something of an expert in a bigger organisation, that becomes useful, then you can get yourself the opportunity to progress. I think that's one key feature. I think the other thing is you know, everyone says, and it's true, real estate is a people business. And I think, and I always have liked people and get on with people pretty well. And I think I'm relatively adaptable to situations with different people, whether or not it's serious or light-hearted, or there's people with different dispositions. I like that side of it. Mm. And I think very often people get senior in businesses because of their technical abilities. But if they're not good at managing people and motivating and building a strong team culture, then that's a deficiency. And you see that in all industries. But I think that's one of the most important things to get right. Mm. If you can shape something that people want to be part of.
Do you feel like you're doing that, you know, at Legal in General now? You know, what is the experience that you want your employees to have working at Legal in General?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time and energy on that subject. I want everyone in Legal in General, Investment Management, the Real Assets Division, I want them to be excited and enthusiastic, have fun, rise to challenges, and be excited about achieving stuff, and probably quite importantly, I want them to celebrate each other's successes. That's what builds a team.
How do you encourage that?
Part of it's leading by example. Part of it's how you hire people. Part of it's how you communicate, and it's an ongoing thing. That's 24/7. For me, it's about walking around the business and engaging people in conversations, asking them what they're up to, asking them either challenging or silly questions, or just keeping them stimulated and making them know that my curiosity hasn't faded. I'm still really interested in all the things we're doing. And even now, every day, I've got all sorts of questions running through my head, and I will ask people around me those questions to stimulate them, and partly because I want to know the answer.
What advice would you now give to your younger self entering the property industry? Knowing what you know now.
Yeah. I would say that thirst for knowledge and enthusiasm around it, as I said before, is important. At the moment, in some ways, I think that's tougher now. There's so much information and data, and access to information is easy now. And when I came into the industry, if you wanted to know stuff, you'd probably have to go to a library and read a book. Mm. So the new skill set that really matters now is how can you sift through this mountain of information and data we can all access to get to the ingredients and the bits that matter the most in order to make yourself valuable as an expert in something. I think that's tougher than it used to be. But that's about finding something that's exciting, that you're interested in, that you want to know about. And then having the desire to project that a bit. There's little point having expertise in your head but without communicating what you can do and what you can bring and what you can offer. And actually, mostly I find young, talented young people in the industry not willing enough to communicate. I think it's hard because they haven't got confidence and they haven't got the experience, but I would say it's worth thinking a bit about how do you project what you know. That's probably the bit that I wasn't very good at and got better at.
Mm. Good advice. Presumably you're quite alive to the changes that technology and data and artificial intelligence is making and has the potential to make to the industry. To what extent are you embracing it?
There's a huge change that could potentially take place. I think the industry we're in has been slow to realise that, and over decades very slow to evolve. And that makes the opportunity even more exciting. What are we doing now? We have a something called an innovation lab that we've formed, which is a group of people internally, quite a few of the Gen Y group, but not exclusively.
And are they property trained or tech trained? Or
it's a mix of people internally, some of whom have got a bit of background in technology themselves, but in a sense I would see that as being more lay people rather than technical people particularly. And what we're doing with that group is bringing that together with some external experts to figure out what in our industry needs challenging and disrupting, prioritise that, find the companies that can help us with it, find a way of helping those companies be successful at what they do. And you know, that's a project that I'm absolutely fascinated by. Really, really tough to make inroads in it because there's so many tech startups. Prop tech is massively a growth area, easy to talk about, harder to do stuff. But I really think we can't afford to sit on our hands, and I'd like LNG to be in the vanguard of that for sure. We do have a team that experiments with some of the high-tech inventions, and you know, will spend time figuring out whether or not particular technology and the associated behaviours are worthwhile or not. And some of the people in my research team typically will, you know, that they'll use the wearables and figure out whether or not that changes their life or not. We've got people experimenting with the pollution technology and quality of air in the office environment. There's those sorts of things we're experimenting with, and but really above all else, trying to figure out where should we be collecting data. But this isn't about technology. It's about how can you run a better business and then use technology to do that. So we're starting with the business model and the business priorities, and then bringing technology to it. It's got to be that way around.
How do you think the industry should find the best talent and retain the best talent? I suppose in a day and age where being entrepreneurial is quite sexy and much more enabled because of technology, you know, there, and you know, we've spoken to a lot of young people who are very keen to emulate the success of like successful prop tech startups, for example. Mm. How do you think the industry in its traditional sense can capture that talent, rein them in, and make, you know, provide them with an exciting proposition?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think we've already made some progress in terms of broadening the pool from which we bring people into the industry. So if you think back in the day, there were several places like Reading and Cambridge and Oxford from which most of the people in the industry of surveying would be drawn. Now you'd say that the diversity of people with a whole range of different backgrounds is much improved. But the task ahead of us is to make sure that we can propagate the idea that we're in a really important, really exciting industry that has the capacity to massively contribute to the growth and productivity of the UK and change people's lives in terms of the quality of the built environment. So I think it's an industry that can be justified as being truly interesting and important, but we've up until now failed to do that terribly well. So we've got to get out and talk to school children and people in all sorts of different places and shout about the significance of the industry we're in, and move on from just taking surveyors out of surveying training, because that is inevitably groupthink. It doesn't represent the widest or deepest pool of talent, and we've got to do something about that. I would like to spend more time in schools and in a range of higher education establishments, but you know, it isn't just colleges and universities. It does have to start earlier. It does have to be in schools.
Mm.
How many school children know that a shopping centre down the road where they and their family would go shopping is owned by a long-term investor? And typically people will not know that. But so the connection with what we do has not been made.
Do you think they'll become more apparent with, you know, large and quite impactful regeneration schemes, which you guys do, you know, very well? So I suppose what you're saying is, how do you relate what you do in the office to, like, you know, the cultural and social aspects of our everyday lives, you know, the buildings and the places we interact with. Yeah. How do you make that happen besides going to schools, talking to people, sort of waving a flag around?
Yeah, I think to some extent we're getting better at making it more obvious which buildings we own, for example, so that if someone was going to a build-to-rent scheme or if someone were to go into a student accommodation scheme that we had funded, there's more visibility about LNG than there used to be. Because until 3 to 5 years ago, we were completely invisible. The common behaviour for real estate investors is to be invisible, because if you're invisible and someone's got a complaint, well, you know what, your phone doesn't ring. But I think that's a dereliction of duty and timid. I think actually it's much better to be out there, set your standards high, be out there, own the real estate you own, and be willing to be accountable for it.
Hmm.
And then maybe people can see and taste and experience a bit of what you're doing. And you're right, the regeneration schemes where hitherto derelict sites in diminished cities can then become vibrant again with places to work and play and live. You know, that's really exciting. We're doing that, but I'm not looking for personal recognition, but I think the industry should be recognised for the good it can do. I think government selectively does get that. At local government level, when people talk to us, where the public sector engages with us, they absolutely know the benefits that long-term capital can bring, and they really get it, and they're willing to profile us as part of that as well.
Mm. Where do you think the property industry will be getting their future talent from then? You know, you've got the traditional Oxford Brookes and the Reading, which are, you know, great great establishments. But do you think we have to cast the net wider? And are you?
Yeah, I think you should be. Well, I think we should be looking to gather in talent from all schools and all places of higher education, and for talent to be considering coming into our industry rather than thinking about it as an afterthought. You know, if we're going to disrupt the industry, if we're going to grab hold of the opportunities offered by technology, if we're going to really add as much value as we could in terms of regeneration and provide occupiers with what they really need, there's a lot of creativity around that. There's a lot of imagination required, and conviction and persuasion and influencing skills. We do need talent if the industry is going to fulfil its potential. So I think we should be gathering in talent from all of those places.
Do you think there needs to be built-in strategies, I suppose HR strategies or talent acquisition strategies,
yeah,
in companies? Do you think, I mean, how much more work needs to be done on that front?
I think maybe a good role model would be the likes of PwC and KPMG. And they have a predictable, committed program to get around all these places and to get people to understand what their business is and what it does, and I suppose sell the story. And we do some of that, but we don't do it as often as we should. We don't do it as widely as we should, and we don't do it as intensely as we should. It feels to me that the war for talent between our industry and others is very real. And the war for talent between ourselves and our competitors is very real. So I think it will pay back to invest more time and effort in that. But I agree with you, there's more to do.
Mm. What does success look like to you? Like, what is the finish line for Bill Hughes at Legal & General?
You know, it feels to me that the horizon is always moving away from me. I'm surprised that I never sit there and reflect on achievements at all. I'm always looking for the next summit. And
you should take your own advice. Celebrate successes.
Yeah. Well, I should. Yes. I'm perhaps not as good at doing that as I ought to be. But it's because I continue to have a thirst for knowledge. I continue to be unsatisfied by where we've got to, and there feels to me always a whole lot more to do. So I can't ever really see the finish line, and I don't ever fully get a sense of having achieved or having got to the summit. And the reality of it is, the more you do, the more you realise there is ahead of you. You know, it always feels like a job half done.
Mm.
But that's, you know, that's what makes it exciting. There's a whole range of new challenges. If I was painting by numbers and spinning plates, but I'd arrived running the business I want it to be, I don't think it would be interesting. And it remains incredibly interesting and incredibly challenging.
Excellent. So let's imagine you're sitting in an interview room with someone and you're interviewing them for a prospective job. And we get to that point in the interview where you say to them, "Do you have any questions for me?" What do you suggest they ask you?
I think things like, what are the biggest strategic challenges for the business? What are the things on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis you struggle the most with? What do you look for in employees? What are the things that matter the most to you in employees? They're the sort of things that I would be thinking about as being important, and it would be, and for someone to ask me those questions would be interesting, partly because it demonstrates a desire to be empathetic.
Mm.
The people who read me the best are the ones who've thought what it's like to be running the business, and not only do I find that more interesting, it also makes those people more valuable to me because they can help me more.
Good answers. The future of the investment market in the UK, what does it look like? Well, let's say globally, actually. It's very much a global market.
Okay, yeah.
How is it changing? And in 5 years' time, what do you think?
Okay. I think the desire for capital to want to own real assets is very strong at a global level and not going away. So there's investment capital that wants to be in the asset class. For the asset class itself, I think there's all sorts of dynamics to do with demand. One is the aging population and healthcare funding and indebted public sector, meaning that there is a requirement for investment there for assets that will definitely be needed by society. So that's one area which I think is on balance pretty positive for investors. I think the other generic area of what I would call cyclical assets where supply comes and goes, I think that's more problematic. I think the aggregate demand for offices, the aggregate demand for retail is under some reasonably difficult influences. So I think there are headwinds. And in that space, the challenge will be to be making sure you're in the right assets and to elegantly not be invested in the assets that are most at risk. So that's a challenging area. There is no point us owning or developing buildings that are not where occupiers want to be. And so being highly selective is what we must do. And I think that's a global phenomenon. I think it's global.
What are the headwinds?
Well, headwinds are represented by office occupiers becoming more discerning, and part of that is to do with technology and home working. In the retail sector, it's much talked about, but it really is making a difference now. E-tailing and most recently, sterling devaluation means import prices are higher for UK-based retailers that import their goods and are selling to UK customers. You know, they've just lost 15% from the bottom line. So there are some headwinds based on the current situation as well as more long-term strategic factors. And it's tough. I think our industry needs to take a long, hard look at itself and be realistic about what the future might hold. But one thing that seems inevitable to me, and it's being talked about a bit now, leases are necessarily going to need to be not just shortening, they're going to need to be shorter. And we need to be capable of managing assets that can provide some flexibility around leases and be really good at managing assets so that they're full and that we retain occupiers because they want to be there, and we're good at making lettings to new occupiers rather than trying to sign a lease for 15 years and then going to sleep. That's the sort of thing that we're all going to have to wake up to, and I see signs of that happening. It's philosophically, it's very much like the build-to-rent sector where all we end up with is an array of short leases. But if we're good at our job, we make that look like a long-term secure income.
So the industry is showing itself to be adaptable in many ways, do you think?
Well, right now, I think it's very early stages. And I think some organisations are setting out to grapple with the shorter term lease world, and the ones who do that well will be the winners. It's good at one level because it means that the value of asset management is going to come to the fore more, and the differentiation between people who are good and bad will be way more visible. But I don't see everyone responding to that. I think there will be winners and losers.
Okay, so a couple of quick sort of questions on the topics that I think many people in the industry are talking about. Collaboration. What does it mean to you in a property context?
I think of collaboration as being timely communication about what you're doing with people who can help you, and then a shared view of what you can do together to achieve more. And it needs to be based on trust and a shared agenda and alignment of interests, and then collaboration can be useful.
Where do you think it's been done well?
A good example for us would be where Legal & General's industrial fund and the expertise we have around industrial from a top-down point of view about the economy and strategic asset management works together with JLL's on-the-ground detailed market knowledge and ability to sweat portfolios and act efficiently. And together we collaborate, very open communication, and the outcome is better than either they or us could do alone.
Who or which parts of the industry do you think should collaborate more and why?
From an industry point of view, I think there are areas where organisations that would ordinarily compete need to work together. Some of that would be around government policy and trying to influence and shape what government do. So a good example at the moment would be having a grown-up helpful dialogue around how procurement is going to evolve post-Brexit. That would be something where the industry needs to work together. I think another area where collaboration is relevant and needed is in sectors that are emerging, not yet established, and where we've all got an interest in making sure that we help each other do the right thing. There I've got Build to Rent in mind. And I'm more interested right now in Build to Rent, where rather than think about our competitive advantage, I'm more interested in working together to collectively set sensibly high standards so that we can provide improved industry reputation, and we can professionalise the industry together. We can help grow talent and educate people around what we're up to so that it becomes an established sector. There would come a point then where competitive behaviour becomes more important than collaboration, but at the moment I absolutely think collaboration is important, and to present again a united front to the housing minister and the leading politicians and advisors is what we have to do.
So that takes me on to my next question, if you know, which has become highly politicised in the Grenfell Tower tragedy. What do you think is the right response from the property industry?
I think there's a few things there. You know, it's obviously a tragedy that a lot of people think about. One thing the industry is doing is working together to provide short-term accommodation for people who have been displaced and are looking for a roof over their head. And there's an organisation called Land Aid that's organising that. We, are, as an organisation, have offered some of our empty space to help. So that's an immediate response that we're in a position to help with. I suppose the bigger picture really is to ensure that the quality of what we build for the future is fit for purpose, that there are no corners cut, that buildings are as habitable and safe as they really need to be. So, you know, like lots of organisations, we've of course conducted a, an immediate review of what we own to ensure that it's up to standard and fit for purpose, and that's not revealed anything that I'm worried about. But the whole industry needs to really be honest with itself about, has it been cutting corners, and the future building standards need to be absolutely sacrosanct at a certain level so that this disaster doesn't happen again. So I think it is a real wake-up call. It's about quality of what we do in the built environment, really. It's a reminder that we've got to really take that seriously.
Okay. One of my favourite last questions that I always ask is, what is your favourite emoji?
I have no favourite emojis, because I don't like emojis. That makes me sound like a Luddite, doesn't it? I'm not a big fan of them.
No, you're not the only one to have said that.
Yeah. Someone sent me an emoji the other day, which is of someone fishing. I suppose that would probably be my least worst one. Yes.
Okay, but note to people, don't send you texts with smiley faces at the end. All right. Well, thank you very much. That concludes the interview. Appreciate your time and all the advice and the tips and the insights. Been really fascinating.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you. That was Bill Hughes, who heads up Real Assets at Legal & General Investment Management. If there's anyone else you'd like to hear from in this podcast, tweet us at Estates Gazette. Or even better, put your questions directly to some of the most insightful people in property at EG's Connecting Tomorrow's Leaders event. It's being held on Thursday, the 13th of July at the Crystal Building in Royal Docks, London. Visit estatesgazette.com/events to book your free tickets.